Hi, this week on the Spotlight Report, we are speaking to Edward, who is a...
It's so weird, like...
Yeah, well, we're going with it. We're speaking to Edward, and he's a student of Professor Jim Schwegerling. He's done research on a large number of things, and his current focus is on topics relating to visual optics. Visual in the sense that human vision is involved. Mm.
Welcome.
Thanks for having me. This is really cool. I've never been interviewed before, so this is really interesting. I really like what you guys got going on here with these spotlights.
Yeah, thank you. So why don't you tell us your background? How did you get into optics?
Sure. That story is actually quite interesting. So I had no idea about the field of optics. As I was a undergrad physicist and was going through that process to look for grad schools in physics, because really nothing you do with a physics degree besides go to grad school. and it turns out I wasn't very good at physics, so I had to start looking around to say, what happens, right? What do we do here? You know, everybody takes the physics theory and knows that test. So long story short, I was actually back home with my father, and he's a painter. So we were going out to a job to paint a house in, I think, Penfield or Brighton or somewhere there. And it happened to be the house of two University of Rochester professors in optics. So I got out, started to do my thing. He said, hey, he's a physics kid, blah, blah, blah. So I started talking to them. They told me about the entire field of optics, kind of pointed me in the right direction. And then Arizona was absolutely fantastic in their offer to try to bring me here. So that was kind of how I stumbled into this, I guess, if that makes sense. So.
Yeah. Depending on how you look at it, optical scientists have the annoying or great habit of always talking about optics whenever anyone like remotely prompts it, or if it's not prompted and they see something that looks optic-y and they're like, "Ooh, let me tell you."
Right, you're an eye doctor, right?
Yeah, going, exactly.
That's. But for me, see how I'm conflicted on that, because I'm going, no, but I do look at the eye. Right? I've got this weird weird mix of stuff on that, so.
So that bridges perfectly into the next topic. What's your focus?
So right now, we're looking at a very interesting theory on myopia and myopia progression. So for those who don't know, myopia is nearsightedness. So you see the geeks with glasses and their face looks rounded. They have myopia and they can't see very far, right? So, you know, Jim approached me with, Dr. Schwegerling approached me with the idea of looking at a very specific aberration in the eye, and one that isn't currently being looked at by most of the field and ophthalmologists and things like that. And what we really want to do is we want to try to get an understanding of how does this aberration A, manifest itself in kind of a natural form. There's a bunch of different optics, everybody's crystal lens thickness and corneal shape and retinal shape is all different. So how does the signal change person to person? And then as well, can we measure this, right? Can we actually take a picture of the retinal surface and pick up this signal, basically. So that's really high level kind of what the work is based around, and that's what my dissertation is focusing on.
Dr. Charles Falco rubbed off on me, so what I just said, optics scientists are always gonna wanna talk about optics, but the eye was one of the first things studied in optical sciences by, I don't know how to say his name. I'll put a link up to it. But it was this Middle Eastern guy who did some of the original work for optical sciences and how we understand mapping and stuff.
Right. Pinhole camera, right? Came out of that?
Yeah.
Camera obscura?
Right.
Yeah.
Insane. It happened in, like, BC, I think. I'm going to put a link up. I don't want to talk too much about it because I don't know. actually too much. But yeah, it still is a very heavily studied topic. Like, vision science is super important and very tangible because we can all relate to it. So, on top of that, you did a bunch of other stuff in grad school. Why don't you tell us some of that? Because I met you in the machine shop doing training to become machine certified. So hopefully you're not using machines on the human eye.
No, we have not. we haven't sent any sharp objects into the eye just yet to poke around. But no, when I first got here, I remember my first lab tour with Jim, and I looked at him and I said, look, I don't want to be pigeonholed in my research, right? I had a big fear that if you do a PhD, you come in, you get very specialized, and you are, you know, this expert on one thing, and I understand that's the definition, but that's not my character, it's not how I work, any of that kind of stuff. So I told him I want to see as much as possible, and I knew that coming out of school, that would be detrimental in terms of I'm not the expert in something. I have to sell myself and be good enough in each of these little areas to consider, okay, you know, how do you stitch a PhD together, right? So, to give you kind of an overview, I've done fabrication, design, metrology, all four optical systems, freeform optics, things like that. Characterization, early formation techniques, compression molding, diamond turning, that kind of stuff. For a new material, which is the infrared polymer that we've worked on, which is out of the Pyung group in chemistry. And then after that, we've done visual simulation in terms of eye modeling, eye tracking, and now this latest work, basically population eye modeling for kind of larger end global type of patterns, right? So a lot of simulation design, like we said, we met in the machine shop, trying to, make parts. Really, if you look at optical sciences, we're starting to reach this trend where we want kind of multidisciplinary folks wherever we can get it. And I think the optical engineering groups are really good at that. I mean, if you looked at most students, they're in ZMAX, they're in light tools, they're in a machine shop, they're building, prototype test setups. That's the whole piece right there. So if you know something about each of them, they actually make other parts of your job a little bit easier. So, that was my approach, and I'm honestly seeing more of a trend of that from what employers have been looking for and what students here are actually completing. So it's really encouraging. It's very cool.
Yeah. Is that how you guys met in the fabrication area?
No.
Yeah, we were.
We met several times, but
yeah. Where was the first time?
I think it's a 5:15 slab. I took the 5:15 from Professor Sugaring.
Right.
And I think he was a.
I was in that lab.
Yeah.
I was in the same one.
Yeah.
Yeah, we got to start it before that we can one. Teach it, right? Yeah, go through it.
No, not necessarily. Not every course.
That's true. Right.
This is a hot topic for me, but that sulfur compound, Dr. Norwood's group is using it?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to give a little bit of background for our listeners. The motivation for us to use this is that it's a sulfur compound. You can mold it, and it transmits excellently from low IR up to mid IR. So right now it's a cutoff pretty steeply at like 7 microns, I think. And if you don't work with infrared optics, that is like the gold standard. Like, that's amazing that you can have such broad transmission, and more importantly, that you can fabricate it easily or mold it. Normally you have to work with these god-awful crystals, and it's just terrible. It's expensive and fragile, etc.
Right.
So what were you using for?
So we caught wind of this, and this was pretty early on, and when Dr. Norwood's group had really picked up the polymer, we looked at it and said, this is just weird, right? It's just a cool, how do you make an organic polymer out of waste material that transmits in the eye? You know what I mean? It was an odd, you didn't hear it, right? Because infrared polymers don't exist, right? You have chalcogenides, which are the hot topic right now. And then, like you said, all crystalline structures, CaF2s, that kind of stuff. I mean, that's what you're using. So we just took it right away and said, let's make anything with it, right? Let's look at it and see kind of what it does. So one of the first things we did is we molded some blanks and some discs, and then went downstairs and diamond turned the thing and said, can you do that? Surprisingly enough, it reacts similar to PMMA. The finish is a little worse, but this thing is turnable, right? You can start machining this thing, right? It's technically, its room temperature is, or its transition temperature, which is the glass transition temperature, is when something, starts to move from a, solidified state to kind of a molten state. Technically, that's room temperature for this stuff, right? So if you looked at molding, for instance, heat molding, compression molding, we're not talking about anything significant in terms of heating or cost to do that. I mean, this stuff is basically Play-Doh. Put it in the vise, low pressure, squish it, we're good, right? I mean, as a fabricator, you're going, that's ridiculous. And the fact that you can make this material for pennies, now you move to that rapid prototyping type of stuff. So Jim and I just looked at it and said, let's just make weird stuff. So we've done lens lit arrays in it. We've done a diamond turned spherical surfaces, flat surfaces. We've imprinted a bunch of stuff. We took a dime and imprinted it, and then measured it under the white light. And you could do really high resolution pickup from just kind of impression imprint molding. We're gonna do some spheres and aspheres coming out pretty soon, and just do some basic MTF type of calculations. Window fabrications on the list of things to do. So it's just exploring, you know? It's really just a weird, cool material.
And what wavelength are you focused on?
Right now, we've been trying to look at the mid-IR with 4 micron being the kind of target wavelength band. That's because, A, its transmission peak is kind of right around that 4 microns.
Mm-hmm.
But really, that space is not up to speed yet in terms of low lens commercial application because the detection suites are so expensive still, right? You've got these cooled arrays. You know, you need these things to be on very stable, you know, platforms and things like that and bulky. So we're actually starting to look more at the 1 micron wavelength range now, which has actually a great window for this polymer as well, too. And in that space, stuff is taking off, right? So we've got a couple of things in the pipeline, and I don't mean to be high level on that, but there's a couple of cool things we want to start building, really small prototype cameras that can do some really cool, you know, cool stuff. So,
and that's research-wise still?
That is more commercialization than it is research.
Okay.
So it's transitioning out of the laboratory, which is kind of one of my fundamentals of what I try to do.
Right. So this brings us to the next great topic. you're so dynamic. It's great to interview you.
That stuff's cool, man. Everything's interesting.
You're like a young Daewook.
Daewook is awesome. He is so cool. Take 521.
We talk to so many grad students, and they aren't necessarily excited about optics or research anymore, so it's refreshing.
Jeez, yeah, well, I can feel that.
Yeah.
That fifth-year grind.
Yeah. Or first-year grind.
Oh, my goodness.
Part of what is so exciting about what you've done is that you also dipped heavily into commercial applications,
mm-hmm.
and you took things out of just being lab work. So why don't you talk about that?
Sure. So business has always been very interesting, and right, I'll give you my philosophy as a scientist, right? Science and engineering is a service position, right? You can carve it out however you like, but at the end of the day, if you're trying to advance some study scientifically and push either the theorem and understanding of the world or introducing a new product, you're truthfully in the business of service, and that's service to the public, right, or the science of itself, right? The nature of the science, right? So that's how I view most of my work. So it's not something where you can just look at, do I write the dissertation, write the paper, get the conference proceeding, and it sticks on a shelf because it, you know, ticks up the next, you know, funding source or the next research
right.
bit. I understand that's a necessary evil in this game, right? You have to find money, you have to be able to support yourself. However, you can do your work in such a way that if it advances the field, and it helps for a larger end topic or a larger study, I think that's important. But if you can get it into the public's hands, that's another major, major priority in from what I try to do as a scientist and researcher. So I went to the McGuire Entrepreneurship Program for a year-long program and chose that as my minor. And so in that process, we developed a small startup company, which was LED grow lights focused for indoor horticulture. So if anybody wants to Google vertical farms and things like that, they are amazing, amazing little, you know, micro ecosystems that exist in warehouses and things like that where you're growing and, you know, cultivating crops. The nice thing about this is it's, you know, it's saving up to 90% of the traditional land usage from traditional agriculture. The water usage is almost 90% less, but the problem is you have this high overhead expense of electricity, right? So we've got great LEDs and lighting technology, and they're doing fantastic things. However, plants eat up a lot of light, right? And the conditional methods right now for lighting systems are honestly probably 40 to 50 years back from what they should be, right? So there's just not enough of a push or want to get in that space and make something that's affordable for that, right? So if you take food care, healthcare costs or food, you know, food costs and that kind of thing, and you look at that problem, well, as an optical engineer, you can come in and say, well, let me save you on the one thing that's hammering you, right? So you
right.
can't sell tomatoes fast enough to cover your electricity bill. I'll just save you electricity.
Right.
And we did that through targeted illumination. So I had another a guy working with me who's here in the building, Patrick Kiefer. He's another graduate student here. He was on that team working towards that. And then two other fellow U of A students, John Michael Stilb and Jonathan Beskin, who are my other business partners that were taking on that endeavor. So we built a couple of prototype systems and tried to test them, and we did all the simulation, we did all the fabrication, we made the industry partners, and we took a school-launched McGuire program and then coupled that with the experience and expertise that Pat and I had here in optical sciences and tried to make a product to go send out to you know, set out to the world and into these spaces. And, you know, if I had more time, if I had more people than myself and Patrick that weren't trying to do dissertations, this thing would have been still going, right? And,
right.
you know, kind of carrying on. So that's kind of the overall philosophy of how I view entrepreneurship and optical sciences, I guess.
But you did, at least when I talked to Pat, I understood that you guys did have, like, a base design and some goal.
Right, yeah, we had people who were going to fabricate it for us. We had testers. We had suppliers for electronics. I mean, it really was just a time and momentum thing, right?
Basically, you know, everything.
Right. So we have, you know, we could have gone. We looked at the 6-month sprint and said, we can get to the next stage prototypes, the beta test, do the testing, do all that kind of stuff. But the 6 months beyond that, funding was going to need to be, you know,
right.
much higher increase. Where I'm finishing potentially my degree at that point, Patrick's still in school, right? It just, the company didn't have enough momentum and personnel to carry on that mission past the year that we saw in that runway. So, you know, and that's fine. Like, that's totally, the problem and the project aren't ever going away. But the time and space that we have as individuals or researchers to address it will change in the future, right?
Yeah.
So you can't be afraid to go and try some of those things. You got to just give it a shot, even if you end up not going anywhere with it. So that's my little, you know, anybody wants to go build something, right? And try to sell and give it to people, even if it's a couple, to go try anything like that.
Yeah.
So
I think that's great advice, and it's something that I've been trying to practice more in the past couple of years of just, like, if you have an idea and it's not outright, like, if it passes the giggle test, as Duden would say, then just go do it.
Right.
Just go try it.
I agree.
If you don't have time, it'll fail, and that's okay. At least you tried it.
There you go.
So, yeah, that's how this podcast got started, actually.
Excellent.
Yeah, so anyways. All right, so let's jump into your dissertation, your eye doctor work,
okay.
So I might say.
All right. So I will preface that I have to be a little tight-lipped about it because we have a invention disclosure that's currently pending with Tech Launch Arizona. Tech Launch Arizona is awesome. Great. They're really the best. I mean, that's such a cool, that's a whole another can of worms, but it is amazing that you can come up with invention disclosure and they provide you the resources as a student to go and say,
yeah, and
take you through the process.
So I want to add, actually, right now, we always post links for, like, useful references or things mentioned. So we'll post links to Vertical Farming, Tech Launch Arizona. There's something else in the beginning that I forgot, but I'll go back through and find it. So the links will be there for people.
Cool. Excellent. Yeah, definitely. Just a really great resource to have here, and especially tied in here to the, you know, the College of Optical Sciences. So, how do we want to start this? You think about this all day. It's interesting to, like, how do you want to tell you the story? You want the problem, and you want, like, kind of, what are we doing?
I want at the very least a loose description of the problem.
Okay.
And then we can go from there.
All right. Loose description of the problem. 1.89 billion people in the world are estimated to have myopia, right? This is clinically defined as half a diopter of refractive error, minus a half, and then outward, right? So what happens is, so someone like me, for instance, and viewers can't see this, but I have minus 2.5 correction diopter. So I can't see things. So the things that I see at 20 feet, someone sees at 225 feet, right? With a well-corrected, you know, pair of eyeballs, okay?
Right.
So we have a loss of distance vision. 2.2 billion people, and by 2050, they're projecting that to be about 7 billion people, right, on the planet, right? So it's just, it's a growing problem. It's huge. Everybody who has contact lenses and glasses, they kind of suffer this. The field is full of postulates and some really great ideas and really cool mechanisms, and it is a multivariate problem, right? So there are genetics, there are, right, so I think, Dr. Miller, who's over at the School of Ophthalmology, is the head of the School of Ophthalmology, is on my committee, and I think he gave me the number that if you have two parents who are myopic, your chances are 80% to become myopic, and if you have one single parent that's myopic, you have a 40% chance of developing the affliction, right? So me, my brother, and my sister, two of us have it, one doesn't, right? So that kind of fits in that mold of the parents, one parent having, you know,
right,
myopia. So that's a multivariate problem. There's multiple things going on. So we're not claiming that we have a understanding of why it progresses or why it's the onset or any of that kind of stuff. what we are introducing is a new way of looking at the problem, right? People have taken a ton of different routes to say what is actually happening. So to give you a few of them, chromatic defocus in the eye, right? Red, group, blue, green, they all are going to focus at different focal planes, and that the retina may be able to signal, right, and kind of mediate, give me some middle value between these things. That's one. Peripheral refractive error, right? So if I look straight on, I see the world, but the light is actually hitting multiple field angles across my retina, mm-hmm. right? Perhaps my retina has grown too long or too prolate, so it's that I now have defocus out in the periphery, and that the eye is signaling in again, growing to change and try to accommodate this. Right, so these are the type of things that people have looked at to say, let's take a look to see if this is a study. We're looking at something completely different than this, right? We have a optical signal that we think comes from the environment, right? And this means as you look out into distance, and even if you're coming in close to, you know, kind of, you know, screen work or near work, that kind of area, the signal is always happening, right? And it's constant. And it's natural to the eye, and your brain is correcting it, right? When you introduce or, you know, some of these other factors show up where it's hereditary and myopia starts and things like that, we'll typically do an intervention, spectacle lenses, contact lenses, something along those lines, rigid gaps, permeable, whatever your corrective method. This, for some people, makes the problem much worse, right? For some, it stabilizes, and for others, it doesn't do much at all. It kind of naturally progresses. Right, so we have these different modalities, but we don't have the kind of fix all tool yet, you know, which tells us there's, you know, more to be had. So what we want to look at now is, can we simulate what is the eye actually seeing? Does it pick up this signal? And this is done through ZMAX, right? So we're basically ray tracing from the back of the retina out into some image plane, and we set these at multiple distances and say, does this signal show up? Then we can put in all of these different intervention methods, single value, you know, spectacle lenses, soft contact lenses, and go and say, how does the outcome of this signal change. Right? Is it worse? Is it better? Is it, you know, higher or lower? What is it? What does it do, basically?
Right.
And then coming down the ladder, we can kind of fill in the gaps here if you're curious. I'm just trying to break this down. But now once we have that understanding, let's go and actually take a picture of the back of the retina, right? Let's uniquely image by throwing in a known object, right? We're going to now see how this object is modulated by the optics of the eye and the retinal surface and coming back out, right?
That sounds very similar to my research.
Mm.
In the sense of seeing how something that's known is affected and then output by a system.
Right.
But anyways, sorry.
It's a very interesting problem because of how challenging it is, because you have to have an understanding of what does everything before I reach my first surface of my system under test,
mm-hmm.
what happens in that space, then what is actually picking up and creating the change to this object once you actually image it, you know, on some back image plane,
right?
And pulling out the different factors, simulation tells you one thing, but actually doing this in practice, there's all sorts of realistic issues that show up, right? So getting through all of these things, and we've got tests to verify and check some of these parameters that we've come up with, but especially when you talk about an optical system like the eye, it's so bizarre. It is the weirdest, I'll tell you, and it's just one of the weirdest and coolest optical systems there is. It's not on axis, right?
Yeah.
It will rotate and move. It's in a different medium, meaning your nodal planes have shifted, all sorts of weird angles don't make sense anymore when you go in there, and your detection plane is curved, right?
And,
so
yeah.
Go into ZMAX, right? Just go fish around in some of their definitions. Everything assumes a plane to a plane in air that you do some imaging. So it just presents a very cool and interesting way to look at optics on a very unique optical system. And that's really why this thing is A, so confusing, but B, super exciting, right?
Yeah.
How do you look at this thing? You know, you got to have really clever ways of getting in, seeing the right stuff, and you know, excluding a lot of garbage, right? So that's kind of the global thing. I don't know if we're gonna poke at any of that.
So part of one thing I want to clarify, and I'm gonna keep it. I want to clarify and keep it ambiguous at the same time. You said that originally, just so I understand, that you were trying to determine if some aberration is present.
Mm-hmm.
That, okay, Perfect. So I'm going to give a quick summary. I'm going to give a layperson's summary of your layperson summary.
Okay.
Just to make sure that everyone's on the same page, all our listeners get this. So the eye, Edward said, the eye is totally bizarre. It has a weird shape. Once light goes into it, it changes refractive. The medium that light is going through has changed refractive index, obviously. It goes through a crystalline lens, which can adjust focus. That's part of why you have issues with vision as you get older. That thing solidifies. And then it goes into the back of the eye, and it hits the retina. As you said, that's a curved focal plane. It's already getting more weird. And on top of that, my favorite part about this whole thing, I did research on the retina when I was younger, and we tried to disentangle the processing that the brain does.
Wow.
From the onboard.
What a can of worms.
From the processing that the retina does.
Yep.
Because the retina, people might not be familiar with it, but the retina is made up of a number of cells that are literally actively acting as a computational system.
That's
and correct. They're doing image processing on the fly, and it is bananas.
Right.
It is insane.
Right.
And then you introduce that big thing behind the eye called the brain, and it's all bets are off.
How do you see lines? How do you see curvature? How do you see circles?
Yeah.
The non-linear layout of how the cells are arranged in the retina and the eye.
Yeah.
It's fascinating. It's absolutely insane. So if anyone more technical is interested, go look up log polar imaging, right? So if you look up log polar imaging, that will actually show you how the retina is sampling via cells from the center to the periphery, and it is this bizarre, packed, crazy density. Cones are all packed in the center, and your rods radially sift out and look at, you know, all these different sampling things, right? And, you know, I'll keep giving you some more interesting stuff. If you look at, there's, I think Austin Rorta is the guy who did this work, but R-O-O-R-D-A, I think. Anyway, he was looking at major league pitchers, right? And found that major league pitchers aren't actually looking through the center portion of their eye at the ball, right? You can detect speed much more efficiently in the periphery than you can on the direct, right? So your brain, even in the periphery versus what it's seeing in the central, you know, from the visual cortex from the center of your eye where the fovea is interpreting messages and trying to pick out information differently.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, the whole thing as an optical system is fascinating. It's absolutely fascinating.
I'm gonna toot my own horn, and we're gonna put up links to those two things you mentioned. We'll also put up a link to the research I did, which was studying nonlinear refractory times between rods and cones on axis and off axis in the retina. That is, if you stimulate cones on axis, so color vision, and then you immediately try to stimulate rods, there's some period of time that the rods can't be stimulated. If you go off axis, that period of time is different. And not only that, but it's all nonlinear across the retina. And it was just like,
wow,
insane. So yeah, I mean,
all right, real quick, give me the 10 seconds. How do you measure that? How did you find the response rate to that stuff?
It was a painful process initially. So the initial research was done at the University of Washington in Dr. Riki's vision group, and the University of Washington is one of the only places that still has primate research in the U.S.
Yep.
In fact, it might be the only place. I'm not certain. But they were able to obtain primate retinas and stimulate them using electrostimulation. Mm-hmm. And this in itself is literally an art. I mean, I can't exaggerate that. You're using your mouth to apply a suction to be able to guide a micro electrostimulation into cells. It was wild to watch. Yeah. It was insane. Anyway, so they plotted this data on primate retinas, and they said, okay, well, we want to test it in humans.
Right.
So I spent a period of time where we had a haploscope. That's something where you display one image to one eye, one image to another eye, and you fuse the images.
Right.
Your brain does. And what we did is basically we said, okay, well, you're going to have black screen, and I'm going to stimulate it with increasing levels of brightness of a red dot to stimulate the cones, and a blue dot to stimulate the rods, and the period of time between that stimulation will be varied, as well as the intensity between the two, as well as is it hitting the same eye versus is it hitting two different eyes.
Single pixel?
No, it was multiple. It was a group of pixels.
Gotcha.
So you can imagine you're sitting at a computer screen, I flash a red dot, and there are technically two computer screens, but it appears as if it's one. I flash a red dot to your right eye, and you say, yep, I saw it. And then I flash a blue dot, and you say, yeah, I saw it. And it's all from the same screen. And then I say, okay, well, I'll... Or you'll say, I didn't see it. And then I'll flash them from different screens, and you'll say, yeah, I saw both of them. We can start disentangling, okay, yeah, this seems to be a retinal effect. This isn't processing in the brain which is causing this.
Really cool.
Yeah, it was cool. And I you had to become a dark... A funny little side note, you had to become dark adapted.
Yeah.
And you had to become, like, really dark adapted.
Oh, that's going to be so cool.
So I would wear an eye patch for, like, an hour around the hospital in UW. And then we went into a blacked out room. And then we pulled a trash bag over our head, over the screen, whole thing. And it was, like, you were, I mean, you talk about night vision, man. You were, like, you could see anything. And then you walked out and you're like, oh, my God, I can't see anything at all.
Yeah. Do you have a new appreciation for pirates now? Do you think that's a line of work you could ever pick up?
I get to, 100%. Right. Yeah.
Now, I think I have a new mission in life here, is how to become a pirate.
Well, that's
self-taught, like, from Logan Graves.
I'll write a book about it. My parents actually visited me, and I didn't know that they somehow found their way into the hospital. And, like, they somehow knew where I was. And anyway,
that's a parent's intuition.
Yeah, it's that should be another field of research. Oh, how can parents always know? But they turned, I turned a corner, and I was like, I mean, one eye to my parents' eyes, wearing an eye patch, just staring at them like, what are you guys doing? And in their mind, their faces were the same. They're like, why in God's name is our, is our child blind? So it was good times. It was a lot of fun. Anyways, so that broadly explains you have a weird, physically, the optics in the eye are weird. Processing-wise, your detector, your retina, is ultra weird. And then you have your ultra, ultra weird brain.
Right. Right. So you see where we are very good at saying we do not make any claims on this is the thing that goes, right, drives this, you know, myopia progression. But with all of this stuff going on, we do have information on how does the periphery work versus the central. You know, can you, you can physically see this observable we're looking at, right? So it's a phenomenon that anyone in this room could actually go and experience and see easily through observation. You know, so it's a matter of, is this a new piece of the puzzle, and can we challenge the way the current field is looking and driving to say, hey, maybe there's some new ideas out here. Mm-hmm. That's really what we'd like to accomplish in this dissertation.
And so for your simulation, you simulated it in ZMAX.
Correct.
But you said that you simulated it for a broad swath of people.
That's correct. So one of the challenges with this is we have to generate enough of a population to look at the variations, A, in refractive error, and B, of just the general public, how your corneal shape might be different, the spacings, all of these intricate properties that are very unique to you know, each individual. So that's actually... That'll be probably almost an entire chapter of my dissertation of just how to create that population set. And so for anybody who's interested, there's a paper by Rozema. It's R-O-Z-E-M-A. And I know we're going to be link heavy on this one, but that paper, right, so what that does is it takes something called a covariance matrix, right? Mm-hmm. So you can think about any variance between two things of being the mean and the observation, subtraction, mod squared of that,
right.
Not mod squared technically, but, you know, square of that, and square, right? So you're taking the actual variance of that. But if you want to look at multiple variables all at once, multiple random variables, what is the variance between all of these variables, right? So let's look at it from the eye's perspective. What is the difference in variance from the corneal radius of curvature and now the corneal thickness? And not the corneal radius of curvature, but now the first crystal and lens radius of curvature,
right?
Right? And so this covariance matrix is a bunch of, it's 39 optical parameters that can be readily measured, right? And what it does is it compares and puts everything on a mean of zero, standard deviation one, random observations, and now populates a new data set from this, right? So what we've done is we've taken their covariance matrix, right?
Right.
We've taken out the parameters that we want to measure and control, which are corneal parameters, crystal lens parameters, mm-hmm. retinal radius of curvature, and then created our own covariance matrix based on that. And if you run the identity matrix, you get pretty close to, yes, you can back this thing out. Because Dr. Schwiegeling actually did something very similar where he took data from, I believe it was cataract surgeries, and did the same random covariance or a similar random covariance to say you can now generate unique wavefronts from these surfaces, right? Where actually took Zernike coefficients and did this process. Mm-hmm. So you could do very unique wavefront fitting, you know, or representations, you know, with this method. So that's how we've built our sample 1,000 population, you know, subset of people that span refractive errors from, I think, minus 20 to plus 8 diopters. Right, and so a couple of things with that. I mean, you've got to be careful what your data set is, your sample population that you generate this from. Right, so they took 129 individuals, adults, right, which are different than the children's eye, which the children's eye is very malleable. There are, you know, gender differences between eyes. Statistically, women have shorter eyes, crystalline lens radius of curvature. You can go. There's, you know, literature that suggests these things, but your population data set, right, that you create will pick up these influencers.
Yep.
Right. So it's been this very interesting, you know, are we right? Is this correct? You know, understanding what is this data actually looking like? Are we seeing a representative population? Where is the mean of this, you know, all this kind of stuff. So again, that being a really good check for, are you sure and confident about the data set that you're presenting? Right. And that's kind of what's been one of those big checks of, are you doing your research appropriately? Right. Because you don't want to force things. You don't want to bias things. You want this to be a true representation to to its best ability, which is the right. Small population, 1,000 people. So,
yeah, we just spoke
biostatistic.
Yeah, to biostatistician. Mm. We were talking about some of the a lot of the messy things you can get into with statistics. And
right,
listeners, well, that's one of my favorite topics. Yeah, it's tricky.
Right.
So, but you managed to get 1,000, n equals 1,000.
Right.
Presumably, you didn't have bias or you avoided any p-hacking or anything like that.
Right.
Did you find something significant?
There's a really interesting correlation between the crystalline lens radii of curvature and the thickness of the crystalline lens, and also the distance between the back surface of the crystalline lens and the retinal surface. So if you think about this, the really simple way to figure out when does the radii of the crystalline lens change in the thickness? Accommodation.
Right.
Right? So that was one of the coolest things that I've seen so far, to say, this is a trend, this was a trend in the data set. This wasn't even, right? This wasn't even looking at our system here. But to show that accommodation really is a highly dynamic variable process, right, that is extremely interesting for most of these things. So to give anybody kind of an understanding of where accommodation, right, and accommodation in itself is the crystalline lens will squeeze or will compress or decompress, which changes its shape, and it allows you to bring things from very far away into focus when you move them up close, right? So that's the process of accommodation. The big thing that's very interesting about this is convergence in accommodation, right? So for those who don't know, if you bring an object very close to your face, your eyes not only bring the distance to you, but also will rotate in to look on axis or converge basically to a common point. So there's a process called accommodative lag where the convergence and the distance, right, where the accommodation happens, don't match. And so it actually ends up that while you bring something close into this near workspace, you know, your arm's length away, you actually still have and maintain a focus behind the retina, right? Which is called hyperopic defocus. So this is a quote-unquote lag. The accommodation has not fully caught up with the convergence. a place that this is easily applicable or readily applicable is if you look at VR headsets, VR or augmented reality headsets. They have the convergence problem, and a nasty one at that, right? Your eyes naturally want to focus beyond the screen, right, and at the screen as well, too. As images are produced of far distant objects, right, in this visual plane, your eye is trying to say, this is far away. Right. Let me move this thing here. And people experience what's considered eye strain. They say, I can't keep these on for very long. So that's a really simple way of looking at the kind of convergence problem and how that actually showed up in this population data set. There was these really interesting trends that you could follow, all these little parameters. And, you know, that's really getting into the heart of kind of what myopia does, because the retinal surface can be a weird shape. It can be a different distance. It can have a different range of curvature. They're basically ellipses, right? Mm-hmm. So they have a sphericity to them. Of all of these things now change, what is your brain trying to decipher as its optical or, you know, environmental stimuli? So just really just cool little stuff getting into the, you know, details of it. So that's probably one of the cooler things that I've seen from that and said, hey, that's, you know, that may be real. There might be something there. So.
Yeah. Huh.
I know. This is everybody. Everybody does that same. Everybody that tell that. So they're like, wow. Right? Because you start thinking, your brain's like, wow, yeah. What is my eye doing, right? Can I control this? Can I mess with it? So.
Actually, I don't know if you did, but you produced a model that you can now simulate behavior from this data. Can you talk about how you did that?
Sure. You're talking about the actual physical measurement of taking this? Because we've got an eye model in the lab. I don't know if that's what you
mean. I mean more so the physical, how you took the measurement.
Of this signal?
Yes.
Okay, so that's a...
Is that too detailed?
Let me
rephrase this. So, and this will give a little bit of good background again for our listeners. So Jim Schwegerling, he's kind of the master on the optics of the eye. And I think, right? Okay.
Oh yeah.
You gave me a smile and I was like,
because he's a genius. He's unbelievable. So smart. I can't keep up with him.
I just had this old, you know, Chase Salisbury?
Yeah.
So we talked to Chase about this phenomenon that you get into grad school, and you get into grad school because you're really smart and you've always been really smart, and you step into here and you realize that you're just totally in a different league and everyone else also is really smart. And not only that, but some people are like another level. They're not really smart. They're like literally geniuses. Mm-hmm. And I was just telling my girlfriend yesterday that I had an encounter with someone at work who's not very much older than I am, but is without a doubt a genius.
Yes.
Like, without a doubt has genius level intellect. And it's always so humbling.
Yeah.
When you meet someone where it's just like,
wow. Absolutely. There's a thing that I refer to some grad students and I call it, and it's the imposter syndrome, right?
Yeah.
You know, that is a real day-to-day nasty thing that shows up all the time, especially for me. I never think I belong here, right?
Yeah.
It's always this, like, because you see that. You see people who are 2 years ahead of you, 2 years behind you, right? You see a professor who's got a career's worth of work, and you're just awed by how intelligent these people are and how, because they get it, right? So I attribute science and things like that as a second language. Those folks who are bilingual.
Yeah.
You ever met somebody who's bilingual and they're really good at both, like, both languages, or have a third or fourth language that they're, like, in and out of them?
Yeah.
Science is the same way. They're taking scientific definitions that are rooted in the language of mathematics, and they've understood these things so well that they can talk to you as a person and at the same time flip on this science and mathematics hat, and you sit there and go, I don't know what language you just spoke. Can you slow that down for me, right? So, you know, imposter syndrome, and they're very fluent at it. And it's always impressive to see that, right? So
that's one of the best ways I've ever heard it described. And I like the experience. So Jim Birch is what I love to point to, because it would be like if you and I were outside talking and we were like, I don't know, I better use an umbrella because it's raining outside. The equivalent statement would be, oh, you wouldn't want to run a grinding machine for this much time at this orientation because it's this type of optic.
Right.
Like that. Done. Just like that. Like you would say, hey, I have this, and just bam. And it's just...
I'll never get over it. Yeah. It doesn't matter how many... I know this. How many years I study and I train, it just won't happen. There will be those people, and that is like... We're so lucky to learn under them. We're so lucky that they can even spend the time to go, oh my goodness, do you know that the ray doesn't bend like that? Right? I'm like, these stupid... I remember before my comps, I'm drawing black boxes, tracing rays through the system, right, to principal planes. And I could just see Jim going, like, oh my God. Now the test is coming up, I gotta pass this comps with this kid. Now where he needs to be, you know? So the fact that they even have the time and ability to study with people or work with them, very fortunate, you know, right. And they are amazing, amazing folks. So, you know, not to digress, but
yeah. Well, I just realized actually we're running out of time, and I do want to discuss your perspective on grad school.
Sure.
Yeah. Your methods of keeping sane. Mm-hmm. But before we do, so I just want to close it out. So you got this data, you made a model, mm-hmm. and you got some significant results.
Right.
Presumably, in your opinion, do you think that that'll lead to a better understanding of myopia in the future?
I think we've generated enough results, and they're getting to the point where it's going to force people to bring this new theory into discussion. Right.
Mm. Look at it a little
right. more. I think that there's at the bare minimum a perspective change that will be on the horizon, which is also very encouraging for us. So.
Yeah, definitely. Mm. Yeah, that's the most you can hope. No, it's not the most you can hope for. It's a good hope to have for your research that it's interesting and significant enough that when you get done, other people want to look at it.
I agree.
So, all right. So we dipped into it. Let's dip back into it.
Sure.
How do you stay sane in grad school? There's a lot of really smart people. You work really hard on problems that may or may not have answers. What's your technique?
Man, my technique is staying distracted. That sounds weird, right? I know, I think about it. So one of the big things I've been fortunate to do is I've been able to stay around hockey, which I did, you know, all growing up, played through college. And I've actually been assistant coach for the University of Arizona's hockey team for 2-3 years now, something like that. So I've been able to stay around the game. That's probably my major kind of, you know, outlet. So if you look at that, grad school is very different for a lot of people. It depends on what your personality is, how you act as a researcher. There's a lot of variables that go into this. I know people who can come to the lab all day, 12 hours a day, never get bored, and enjoy the work and love this kind of grind. And they'll write papers and they'll, you know, they're just machines. They're fantastic. They get their juju from work. It's extremely exciting, but there needs to be time off, in my opinion, for what I do. So to do that, it's identifying not many people, but a core group of people that honestly, every so often, you need to just be able to go to them and say, I'm tired, or I don't like this, and can you just listen to me whine for a little bit, please, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so for me, I've been fortunate to have two excellent roommates, two very good friends, Anand Ball and Patrick Kiefer, that I live with. And then really the next step of that is my parents. I mean, I call my mom once a week, and it is my weekly download of, can someone unbiasedly just let me whine for a split second, does life okay on the backswing? Because honestly, it's a very fortunate position to be in, right? Graduate school is a privilege. It's it's earned through hard work, but it's a privilege, and it's really fantastic to be here. So a small subset of people, I think, is very important to just say, I want to be human, and let me yell for a split second. Yeah, I think that's the biggest degassing.
I've been thinking about this actually more recently, and I'm going to share my opinion. I want to hear what you think about it.
Mm-hmm.
Because we do, if you only listen to this podcast and you're not a grad student, you mm-hmm. would be mistaken for thinking that we're quite a whiny bunch.
Right.
And I think that the unique aspect of it is that everybody's life is extremely hard.
Right.
Everybody works hard. Work is tedious. I don't need to expand on that too much. The interesting thing about it is that we have been constantly told, on average, maybe not all of us, but most people you'll find in grad school, and most people you'll find that are doing high-level sciences, not even academics, have this innate understanding that they should be really smart. They should be really good at it because look at yourself. You're doing really advanced science or math. I mean, obviously you have to be smart, so you have to be doing good. And when you run into that wall, when you run into that wall consistently, it's so counterintuitive to that understanding that, that it's just challenging.
Right.
And it's useful to go and complain to someone and have someone be like, yeah, that's totally normal.
Right. So the best way I think about that is, right, take anyone, right, so here's why I say grad school is a privilege. You're in a place where you have like-minded people and you have enough time and resources to look at any problem that you want, which is mostly your work, right, but are not necessarily defined by true, what I would call real-world problems, right?
Yep.
Does the paycheck show up on the right time? Do I have mouths to feed? Do I have a house or mortgage to pay for? Right? These are things that you're somewhat sheltered to. Now, I know folks that are here that have also taken on those things, and I have no idea how they're still here. That, to me, is paramountly impressive, right?
Yeah.
So we have problems because we have two things. We will complain because our time and available resources have been shifted to say, use your brain to the maximum capacity every single day, all day long, to solve these very difficult problems, right? That's the burden that we give up. We give up this free thought and energy to try to help a larger subset, which is science and in the public, right? In the context that we have the resources, time, and availability to look for those problems, right? So a lot of the time you hear grad students, you know, whining and complaining and things like that is simply because of the fact that you're right. You're asked to be smart. And if you don't do anything with a gift, and I agree with this to some extent, you have to exercise the gift and use that. It's a challenge.
Yep.
When you hit a roadblock, when you don't understand something, this identity that has been half cultivated by those around you feels like an imposter. You don't feel like I'm doing what I should be doing, or I'm not getting the results I should be getting, right? And it weighs on you, right? And the only way to get yourself out of it is to think, right? And now, like, that is, if you don't know what to think about, right, and you fundamentally don't know the next step, to think your way out of blank or confusion, try that sometime, right? And find out the madness that involves that, right? Now, all of these things, too, I'll give you another hint. The other things that I've been talking about, all of these processes are devoid of human emotion, right? Are devoid of human context. So not only are you using your brain 24/7, always running, because it doesn't shut off at night, there's still stuff, and actually you get your best results when you sleep, I think, most of the time.
Yes.
It's a non-human process. Couple in real life, girlfriends, wives, family members, relationships, friend groups, your own person, understanding yourself as a person, how you're growing at some point in time in your life, you don't get that extra time for that stuff, right? So all of these things, you're constantly challenged. Be the smart person, answer the smart question, be the best that you can, you know, figure this problem out and figure it out on time before group meeting next week, right? So, you know, do all these things as well. There's a lot of stuff you give up in that. And so that's the franticness, that's the panic, that's the whininess that you hear from, I think, our collective. And it's, and I'll tell you this, if I'm not trying to give you a sob story, what I'm trying to give is the perspective of it, right? Everybody deserves to complain. Everybody has a hard time. It's cool. It's healthy to vent.
Yes.
Understanding what you're venting about is the important piece. And I think that's the lesson for grad students to have, you know, and try to figure out.
Well, and I think everyone has a unique experience to everyone has unique experiences and unique challenges,
right,
and unique things to vent about. But it is also interesting that grad students, by and large, I mean, it doesn't depend too much what field we talk about, have similar shared challenges. But yeah, I'm with you. I've come around a little bit more in the last year that I think it's a huge privilege to be here.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I mean, we're on the U of A campus, and it's April. I forgot the month. It's April, and it's, like, stunningly beautiful.
It's ridiculous.
But I don't know about your lab. Our lab doesn't have windows.
So. No, we have no windows. That's why I came in here. I was putting my feet up, but I'm sitting in this room.
Yeah.
I think they said all the students' labs do not have a window. Yeah, and all great. The professors' that office, they got fabulous window.
That we need, you know what? We need windows. Yeah. That's we're going on strike until we get windows.
Perfect.
We need to know the world exists
we're
out
walking
there.
Out.
And if you pay attention to the first floor, actually all the clock are not on time.
Alright, I'd like
yeah,
to, we maybe need to get
really
some ocean
yeah, they're in the
these working
yeah.
conditions, I don't
yeah.
know.
So the last thing I want to add to what you put beautifully is that I want to expand upon that fact that inherently in the sciences, in grad school in the sciences, but I think it probably applies to most anything, but
mm-hmm.
I especially am familiar with it from the sciences, you are working on, like you said, non-human problems.
Right.
And it's such a weird phenomenon to devote 100% of your brain power, 100% of the time, for 4, 5, 7, or 6, I don't know why I skipped 6 years, to this weird, not human way of being
yeah.
and of living.
Yeah.
Of like thinking 100% of the time, not emotions, just logically.
Right.
It's I don't think it's particularly good, and I think that's why having that balance is so important. And
right.
I think I've looked at, or I've talked to Daewook. Daewook had, had his first 2 children when he was in graduate school.
Mm-hmm.
And it forces that balance on you. You no longer have
right.
the luxury of saying, like, well, I have to focus on this 100% of the time because I have two kids, right? Or
right.
et cetera. I mean, it's having that balance of getting pulled back into, like, oh, well, I'm a primate on this rock in space. You know, like I'm a human,
right.
I'm not a machine.
So let me give you this. Let me give you this anecdote, and I want to try to tie this into something that I think about quite often in kind of a larger picture. I asked my mother one time. She's got her master's in nursing, right? She's a well-educated woman. She's very smart, incredibly bright. She's fascinating. I love this. You know, I love this woman to death. I asked her probably about a month ago. I said, "Mom, do you know what it's like to feel absolutely nothing?" And she kind of says, "What do you mean?" I said, "Have you ever had a point in your life where your brain was so consumed that you couldn't even muster up panic? You couldn't muster up anxiety? You could even the natural things that exist all the time, anger, sorrow, happiness, nothing. You could get nothing." She goes, "Honestly, I've never, ever, ever experienced that in my entire life."
Yeah.
And that was profound for me, right? That was profoundly shocking. That
yeah.
that scared me, because what that told me was, is in this very unique position of graduate school, I don't care where you are and what field, there will come a point where you are so devoted to this work, to solving the problem, to making that all-encompassing, that you will find that point. And it may be a split second, and I hope that that's the case, right? But the larger perspective of this is if you can understand these things, or if you can't, right, have someone who's gone through a master's degree, even that, empathize with something like that, right? And they can't find the empathy for it. It really drives home the fact that you should very carefully listen to everyone and anyone who is around you. And
yeah.
this goes for graduate students looking out on the periphery, going and saying, "I don't care about your story of what the machine shop did downstairs. This doesn't pertain to me." That person has a real life and real considerations going on that are far beyond your wildest dreams.
Yeah.
At the same time, these highly educated weirdos that are running around rattling on about God knows what, right? They might be thinking about this in a completely different context, and just don't brush them off as I'm too intense or I'm too smart or I can't be, you know, talked to. And really the message is you can find common ground with anyone, but the common place only starts if you start listening, right? And that was the thing that has been driving me. So, you know, to talk about what do you do in grad school and how do you stay sane? Honestly, people, and it doesn't need to be many, but anyone. You go talk to your grocery clerk. I did that my first year. She must have thought I was insane. Like, "Hi, like, you're a human? I live by myself in an apartment. I just wanted to say hello. All the world is burning around me," right? So just, you know, thank you for smiling and nodding. But that's really the thing. If you can find the common ground to start listening,
yeah.
I think you have the actual perspective to truly empathize and really hear these different plights that you get from all walks and all educations. So.
I don't know, I feel so touched somehow.
Yeah, I spent a lot of time to think about this stuff, so it's cool. This is, I think this is some of the most interesting stuff that's currently out there. I love talking about people and how these unique situations show up, so.
Yeah.
And you're fantastic for bringing new perspectives, you know, to the world, and from such a close number of people that do this kind of work, it's great to be able to express this and just talk openly about it. So I think you guys are doing a fantastic job with this podcast. It's been a real pleasure to actually hang out and sit down this afternoon.
Yeah, well, thank you. I think on that note, we'll go and reflect on the experience of grad school. So thanks very much, man.
Yeah, man.